Thanks for joining us on the Design Podcast. I'm your host, Ashton Snook, and we're on a mission to share the creator's voice. Today, we're joined by David Schwartz, founding partner at the multi-award-winning experience studio, Hush. David, welcome. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Super excited about chatting. David and I caught up prior to this, obviously, to the pre-record and run through some ideas. I think some of the best conversations I've had on the show so far. So I'm really, really stoked to get into this conversation. So today we're going to be focusing on Hush and your personal journey with building that over the last 15 plus years now. 15 plus years. And we're going to be, you know, sort of unpacking the realities of starting and growing your own studio. I guess the good, the bad, and the ugly through that experience. But before we get into that topic, I always love to start by asking, what led you into design initially?
I think the lens through which I entered it was probably an architectural lens. When I was a kid, that felt very close to me, like thinking about space and designing spaces and, you know, traveling and seeing interesting spaces in the world always kind of resonated. I mean, this was pre-digital, right? So I didn't have that kind of access point at the time. I didn't grow up in a community where the arts were flourishing, right? I was in the suburbs. I didn't have a lot of models, you know, friends, parents, things like that, that were doing design in any really way. But there were some architects floating around. So I kind of like sought those people out, you know, to understand what they did, not as a practice, just as like, whoa, that's something that like my brain works like that. Okay, cool. So that was sort of the root in, although, you know, I would always say I was always, you know, drawing or making something. And I threw a lot of ceramics, you know, when I was younger, I did a lot of drawing and painting and things like that, but I never thought of myself as a designer or like an artist or anything. I never put that label on myself. I don't know why. Probably because I didn't have the model. That the model generally gives you the confidence to, you know, to say that. And yeah, I didn't have the model. So that's kind of how I started. I three-dimensional space, you know, that was really how I got into it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I always wanted to be as a kid, when architecture was like that route. I was either going to do illustration and art or wanted to design buildings. And as I got older and realized it was going to take 7 years to get the degree, I kind of veered away from it. I just thought there was going to be too much of an investment for me to do that.
You and me both. So I think we were both attracted to the idea of architecture and the architect. But then when you start to peel the layers back about what that actually is as a practice, what it takes to get there, what getting there means, and sort of the long journey and very small percentage of real success, it sort of like demystifies this thing a little bit. Like I think someone said architecture is awesome in a movie, you know. Like architects are always cast, you know, as the— it's like that's the profession that's cast when you want to have like the Richard Gere kind of cool, enigmatic, you know, but artistic kind of character. But, you know, the pragmatic aspects of the field, I think, are quite troubling. In fact, I did a post undergraduate summer program at the Harvard GSD as a grad school kind of portfolio builder to like really level up if you didn't, you know, focus on architecture in your undergrad. And I think we had a lot of amazing speakers, as you might imagine Harvard can kind of get.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most rigorous 3 months I ever spent doing anything. And I loved every minute of it and slept on the floor of the Carpenter Center, which is this really brutalist, you know, 60s building. It's very uncomfortable to sleep on the floor, but it was incredibly inspiring. But we had Richard Meyer come in and do a talk, and you know, he'd looked at whatever was 100, you know, potential architectural, you know, enthusiasts, students, future practitioners. And he literally said, do not enter this profession. I mean, without even like a wink, like, I'm here, this is what I do. It's my whole life, but it's not a profession that it's just been broken. So anyway, I think you and I both ended up in the same place, which was, how else can we flex these muscles and this itch we have? And could we get there in another way? Which is sort of like basically what I've done my whole career, is trying to cheat my way in shorter back door, you know, like just find the way in, even if the path is unclear.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. So you went on from high school, I guess, and you went and studied, I think, both media design and economics. How did those two things sort of come to pass as courses for you?
One was before the other. So I did undergrad at a liberal arts school called Colgate. Great school, but, you know, very broad. And then I did a grad program in LA at Art Center, which is it's just an amazing school of just rigor and work and just intellectual curiosity. Again, like probably one of the most just incredible, you know, few years of my life in terms of focus and just like diving into subject matter. So it was in sequence. But I think it's interesting, like I didn't have necessarily the models in growing up to know what I wanted. And I didn't have, therefore, the confidence in myself to really find that path early. So I'm kind of weird. Like, I can think about things through like a business and, you know, entrepreneurial economic kind of sense, quantitative. But I also can kind of flip the switch and go the other way. And I think, you know, economics was just a way to anchor into something that maybe was more familiar to me as a model. I didn't enjoy it per se. So what I did was I did it really fast. And then I spent my last year at school just doing art history, architectural history, figure drawing, illustration, pottery, and just all the things that were like love. And then that's what kind of clicked. And at that point, I was, I think, emotionally mature enough to be like, oh, this is it. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. And I know you went from, because you studied in LA and then you moved, I think, was it like the late 90s, 98, 99, to that dot-com boom era. And you got into working in, I can't remember the name of the studio now, but like an interactive studio, didn't you? Then you moved from college into that space. How did you start to get your foot in the door in the San Fran scene at that time?
Oh, it was rough. I thought I was so smart. I did really well in school, you know. I got there. It was like a whole new world, you know. It was 99. This was like really early days of web, right? Web was just kind of figuring out what it was, its norms, its standards, you know, design kind of language. But it was super exciting. I mean, this was the time where, you know, companies were starting and dying, you know, within a heartbeat, a lot of capital flowing around. And that's kind of what happened was I realized I had this affinity for this stuff, because now I had a community of folks kind of working in this. A few friends from college had started digital agencies. I kind of could see what that was. Mm-hmm. And I immediately had this weird kind of mental leap where the way I saw the world and through architecture and space, it wasn't a one for one by any means, but I saw that kind of journeying and like layering of information and like moving through space of architecture and program. I saw that in the web. And this was, you know, this was early Flash, pre-broadband. So we didn't even get to like quote unquote rich media, you know, there's WebGL wasn't a thing, right? It wasn't even architectural digital, right? It was flat, but I could still see the kind of space making. I don't know. It sounds strange, but it felt interesting. And I have to say, coming off of the heels of being kind of told that architecture as a profession was a downer by one of the top architects in the world, I was seeking something else that was exciting. And frankly, there was a lot of energy around design and digital. You know, this was the days of Attic. Remember Attic? Like, you know, these amazing, fun, felt like rock star kind of digital design firms that were just like exploring this new medium and all this new language. And so I kind of just got sucked in, you know, and I just hustled, you know, I hustled, and I had one owner of a small agency of about 20 people be like, okay, you're smart enough. You can start somewhere, you know, you can add value somehow. And then I just kind of like, you know, it's all about opportunity, right? It's like, you just insert yourself into anything, try to provide value. People see that and they're like, oh, can you do that again? I'm like, yeah, I can do that again. And nice. That soon becomes what you actually do. So that's kind of just what happened. I got lucky. Someone took a chance on me, and I'm still friends with him today because that stuff really matters, you know?
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And that's very cool. It's good to, I mean, amazing that's rolling back for you to still be good friends with them. A similar sort of thing for me. I was at college, university. And I had a similar sort of revelation. I wanted to go into film, but as the same thing, the lecturers who was teaching film said, don't pursue this. Like, our best students have found no work for 2 years. So now they're working on porn films. Unless you want to work on that, try out design. So I geared back towards doing graphics, and then was fortunate to, I think, sort of like, was that 10, 11 years ago, get into what was almost like the Silicon Valley sort of thing, but in London, which was what was called Silicon Roundabout, was that sort of startup mobile boom. And I was kind of coming, like, sort of, I guess, sort of a little bit later, obviously, the new were into that scene, but similar sort of patterns. There was that big energy around. And thankfully, someone took a chance on me whilst I was still studying, and I got my foot in the door that way.
But were you studying that material specifically, or you had to apply what you were studying from a design standpoint to this new medium?
Oh, that's a good question. I was studying, I did media, like you. So I did film graphics, a bit of web, a little bit of web, a bit of photography. And then I was university to do graphic design. My plan was to do a master's degree, but it was split into like a two-part segment. And I sort of tapped out on the second year, got that qualification. I have no idea what you'd even call that degree. Because I was like, oh, the mobile scene's happening. I was super, inspired by what was happening in San Francisco at the time, and wanted to make my way over to the States at that stage. And I figured, I want to run my own company at some point. I can go up to London, see if I can find the job in a startup and learn what it's all about. Was doing graphic design, built a portfolio out over the weekend, which was absolutely terrible when I look back at it now. Spoke to a few people, rang a few people, and was hired as a Android design lead to look after mobile apps on Android for this little startup, which had like 10 mil worth of seed, which was mind-blowing. And actually the money for working part-time was quite good, and I ended up bunking off from my classes to go to work. And my lecturers were very supportive of it, actually. They were like, don't bother, the master's you're already in, just keep going.
That's nice, because sometimes institutions will hold it over your head. Like, you need this, you know? I think in a lot of ways, I mean, you look at the trends academically, right? It's like the degree is becoming less and less important. A lot of the tech companies are removing requirements around degrees for, you know, hiring and things like that. So I think the trend is right. And I think this is an industry where, you know, I think portfolio speaks above anything. I mean, I can't tell you the last portfolio I looked at where I scrolled to the academic credentials. Maybe out of interest to see if there's any overlap, or maybe, you know, we just share folks, but like, it's almost not, you know. Self-taught or 8 years of schooling, it doesn't really matter. It's like, what are you producing? How do you see the world?
Yeah, we've had that. You go and interview a lot of folks when you're sort of running teams, and I've interviewed people like double masters and 1 year off and completing a PhD in human-centered, HEI, or even doing UX courses now in degrees, which is quite amazing. It doesn't exist when I was at school. And then you're like almost 10 years of education. And we've had someone who's had like 3 years of experience. And the difference was significant. Like we hired the people with 3 years of experience who just self-taught themselves.
Yeah.
Because the academic was just too far from what we needed at the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's definitely less important, I think, than it has been historically.
Yeah, I think it's very hard for academics to replicate the constraints of the real world and the rigor of having to make on deadline and time and with teams and collaborative teams. I mean, that's when you really show value. So It's hard to create that condition in academia, even if you have a great assignment and a great professor and great peers, it's just not the same. I think going to school, where you're going to pay a lot of money, at least in the States, and should be something you do when you have a very formed goal that you need the space and time and sort of insulation to focus on. Because I think that's very hard to do unless you have infinite funds and an arts practice that can just run, you know. So, you know, I think that's great, but that's ideologically challenging. That's pursuing things with good mentors and advisors and infrastructure. That's valuable, which is kind of what I did in my second degree. It was like, I would never have done that if I was wandering. But at that point, I wasn't wandering anymore. I was dead focused on what I wanted to learn and do. And so it was very valuable.
Right. Looping back in. So I've led us on a segue here, but looping back into this, your first experience, when you got into the creative fields, were you working on a very broad range of projects at that time? Or were you really focusing in on a particular segment of creative and design?
Yeah. So I would say my time working at digital agencies was a few years. So that was web. But after I left school, when I got my design degree, master's degree, and I was more kind of focused, I came out, I studied film interaction and, you know, whatever you call it, graphic, you know, more formal kind of graphic language and graphic design. And so it was always a mix of that. And we partnered with like environmental studios and product design studios. So you kind of had this like materials and three-dimensional piece. But I have to say, being in LA, I kind of, you know, was enamored a little bit with like storytelling and the film world and just like the image and photography. So I actually came out of there focused a little bit more on content. So we were doing tons of design, motion graphics. I was directing shoots, that kind of world. And so that bounced me around between New York, LA, and Chicago for like several years, which was great. It was a cool lifestyle. I learned a lot. I got to see into so many studios, so many agencies, like where you understand how their work is made. And also ultimately more interesting was the culture of the place and how that influenced the work and the kinds of people that work there. And so for me, it was like a science experiment. You know, I was just like collecting data, building community, collecting data, what I loved, what I didn't, and sort of, you know, just really amassing information that I would make decisions with in the future. But it was great. You know, it felt really nimble. It was entrepreneurial because you're always hustling. You always got to be fun in your next thing. That was the focus, content driven stuff.
Yeah, I can see how all of this is laddering up to the work that you're producing now at Hush. It makes a lot of sense diving running back to that. So how did you make, you obviously moving around from LA, Chicago, New York, what took you to the East Coast and took you into setting up your roots there and then essentially starting up Hush?
What got me back to New York was a girl, a woman who's now my wife and the mother of my children. So probably a good choice in retrospect.
Yeah.
But I'm from New York, New Jersey. So this is kind of home, anyway. And, so that was just the geographical move, but really what started, moving into Hush was that I was working at a studio called Brand New School. I don't know.
Okay.
And Brand New School does you know, at that time, they were probably one of the preeminent kind of graphic animation design companies around. They had offices in London, LA, and New York. And I met my business partner there. So we somehow kind of met in the freelance circuit and then worked together for a year or so on a bunch of projects. And he was like a technical director, and I was, you know, I was effectively a designer, but pushing up to be anywhere I could be. And I got the opportunity to kind of like direct a bunch of stuff and lead projects. Somehow the owner of that firm had a little bit of trust in me, even though I wasn't a staffer, to kind of help shepherd things at a higher level. And that was cool. So we kind of got to play on that studio's dime and time and learn if we got along and if we had a good creative relationship and also saw the world the same way. Mm-hmm. And we did. And it kind of went from there.
Awesome. Awesome. We'll dive into this, because I think, you know, starting a studio can be a risky thing, can be quite daunting for creatives. And I think we'll tap back into that. But I'd love as well for the audience, because I'm sure your portfolio is amazing. So anyone listening, definitely go and check out heyhush.com, I think.
Heyhush.com.
Yeah. Heyhush.com is your website. But would you be able to give us, David, like an overview of what Hush is for people who aren't familiar with your work?
Absolutely. So the simplest way to say it is an experienced design agency. But as we know, that language is very blurry. So that can be applied to more app and UX kind of firms. But where we define it in the genre of experience design as in real life, three-dimensional spaces. And we design these spaces really to help our clients and organizations connect their own brand, their audiences, and the space they operate in some inspirational ways. And we use technology a lot to kind of make that inspiration happen. So think about interactive spaces. It's like the interactive architecture, media architecture, those things. So everything's in the real world, other than some additionally, you know, virtual and metaverse kind of derivatives of that. But it always really starts with the three dimensions in the real world, getting people to commune and learn and engage in space.
Mm. Yes, that's the real. It's one of those sort of, I don't know, I look at your portfolio particularly and think how inspiring it must be to work in a truly multi-sensory environment. You've got all these different facets you can play with, and we'll get into work in a little bit, but I think anyone listen to this, go and check out David's work, because it is very cool. So Hush is this experiential design studio that's building out these amazing sort of three-dimensional experiences for people like Instagram, Facebook, etc. Now, the risk of that, starting your own studio, can feel a little bit daunting. I've thought about it myself a few times, tried a couple of things with business partners that didn't quite work out. Can you talk us through how you approached this idea? Was it quite an organic thing as you were developing this relationship at this agency? Or did you know, hey, we want to try this thing, and how are we going to get there but minimize, you know, sort of the capital risk to start on our own thing?
It's a great question, and I think it's a really important question to honestly ask yourself, you know, if you're thinking about starting a company. It's like, how much tolerance do I have, or how committed am I? Is this something you want to try to moonlight on and just tease? And if it takes off, then make the switch. Are you just done with the hustle and working for other people, and you just want to do it, and you'll do it no matter what, at all costs? And then there's a million little gradations in between. And I think, frankly, the decision to do these things has to be really, it's not whimsical. You know, there are real costs involved. There's real risk involved. And you have to kind of weigh that stuff before. But that being said, I think here's what I always say. Eric, my partner, and I, you know, kind of danced, kind of like flirted with the idea. And at some point we sort of realized, well, this is a pretty young industry. I think the owner we were working with at the time of the agency was, I think, like only 5 or 6 years older than us. you know? So it wasn't, you know, this is a young industry. You're not going to like, you know, wait it out and become the leader of this thing. It's like, we're all in it together. And I thought we saw what he was doing and we're like, that's what we could do. We have that capability. You know, he was very talented, but we had that interest, I would say. And so we agreed on that. We agreed that the sort of the way we were working was fun, but not forever. And then came this kind of second part, which I advise anyone thinking about this, is really ascertain if your business partner is kind of on the same page with you lifestyle-wise. And what I mean lifestyle is like, what do they want from their life and, you know, bigger things? What are their expectations from a business? What are they trying to do? And some of these things you can't answer at the moment, but you can kind of vibe it out. And that's what we did. And we talked and we kind of had a similar point of view on the world. What we want to do, what we want to achieve, standard of living, these kind of things. So, because I think having a good match there is a good bedrock. Because you can imagine in running a business, having grossly different points of view of what success means will just tear you apart. Because you got to make decisions every day about risk and reward and time commitment. And, you know, and if you're just not on the same page with those basics, I think it gets considerably harder to make it through those kinds of ups and downs. So anyway, luckily, you know, as much as you can know someone from working with them for a year and change, we were well suited, and we still are. We've had an amazing business relationship. So we started with this commitment and we did a lot of homework, which I think is another important thing. You know, did we write a 50-page business plan? No. But did we sit down and write something? Yes. And did we do a competitive analysis of what the marketplace looked like and where our white space might be and trends and what we liked about certain other companies, what we didn't, and what we wanted to try to do with this company different. So we did all that. And that took some months of moonlight working and figuring it out. And we had a mission, which was frankly quite simple, which, you know, do the storytelling we've been doing in the two-dimensional rectangular plane, but with my partner as a technical director and like a 3D expert, and me with this like architectural seed since I was a kid and always thinking in three dimensions. It was like, it's got to break out of the two-dimensional plane. And we have to be able to kind of wrap people with this stuff. And it sounds so simple. It's just like exploding two dimensions into three through content, but in a way that just made it easy to try to say like, that's a big first move. And so that was the differentiator. And we did a bunch of 2D stuff when we started, but, you know, it very quickly became our focus. You know, we didn't, it wasn't a side hustle. That was all we were doing at the company pretty soon, you know, after the first few years. But back to, you know, starting, you have to rip the Band-Aid off, I believe. You know, it's very hard. And so we did all the legal setup. We built the business. We did the paperwork. We drafted the partnership agreement. We redlined it. We went through it with attorneys. We did all the hard, awkward stuff when you're starting to kind of, you know, start a business. You don't want to do this stuff later. You want to have really clear conversations. What if conversations?
Yeah,
get it done. Because I work with a bunch of other founders and people who didn't get it done, and now they're, you know, 5 years in, 10 years in, they have a existential crisis or existential opportunity. And it's a very hard conversation to have when, you know, when it's an important moment. It's much easier to have just as like, hey, we have to guess the future.
Yeah.
So we did all that stuff and then we just cut the cord and we didn't touch any other work ever again. And I can assure you that was very hard to do the first year when you're watching your bank account just go down, 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 down. And you're like, what are we doing? We could be doing this other thing and making a lot more money and frankly, having a lot more of a simple professional life, you know, get booked in a job, do a thing and then go home. But that's what you got to do. You got to just keep keep plotting forward.
Yeah, it makes total sense. I mean, I mentioned before, I tried a couple of startups with some friends, or I'd say like more like work friends, right? A similar sort of setup. I think there was a couple of things that sort of we weren't aligned on where we were. I mean, one of the folks I founded started to found a company with was making like £1,000 a day, which I guess like $2,000 a day. That was amazing. I was making like $150. I was not making anywhere near that. So I just didn't have the capital. And I straight out of school and working for another startup. So that was kind of challenging. The second time we got really deep into a partnership, almost figured out all the legal stuff, did loads of research. But the problem again, lifestyle, we weren't in the same place. So financially, we're in different places. One was having a kid. One had decided to quit their job. I was trying to hold down a role at a brand in-house and do this thing. So I totally get that. That is very good advice. And I've heard similar things from other founders as well over the years about sorting things out early. How did, you know, and the capital risk is a big thing. How did you go about, you know, you band-aided it, but was it as extreme as we've got this idea, we want to get Hush set up, we'll dive into it with both feet? Or did you have some clients or a client in mind that you were starting to build those relationships with as you moved into building the business?
They say that's the smartest thing to do. We didn't do it. I would have loved to have had someone ready to be our first client or sign us up, and then we, you know, transition to take that client on. That's a story you hear a lot, and it's a great one. Unfortunately, we didn't have that. I don't know if we were looking hard enough for it. I think we just knew they would come. But we just jumped. And then we marketed, and then as I'm sure other folks have talked with you about, your network is, you know, your key asset. So if you can commit, you can find a good partner, you can be on the same page financially, lifestyle wise, and vision for the company, then your community and network become kind of the thing. They will be the proselytizers of your new brand that no one knows from anything, and they will vouch for you despite having zero portfolio or track record. Well, maybe track record, but zero portfolio doing this. You know, that you might have done creative work before, but within the machine and context and support infrastructure of a bigger company or agency, and it's definitely not the same thing, right? Being able to do good work through an existing structure and a well-known brand versus a fledgling unknown brand with no structure, no infrastructure, is a totally different process. So as luck would have it, you know, that network came to bear, and actually a current client of ours who was at Uber, not anymore, but was at Uber for some of our biggest Uber projects that we just launched in the last 6 months. He was actually our first client when he was at another firm, and he's reached out because I knew him from grad school. And that's exactly what happens, right? You have someone who's talented in a position of power in terms of being able to run and finance a job. They need help. You don't have a portfolio to speak of, but you have a reputation, and they trust you. And then you have this really wonderful open line where you're solving problems together, and it doesn't feel like a, you know, a typical kind of relationship. So there it was. That was our first one. So it was a small job, probably, you know, 100K or something like that. And it was, but, you know, it was, we were able to speak very openly and honestly. Hey, we've never, you know, we were building the track, laying the track as the train was going down the station, right? So it's like, oh, how do we budget this? Oh, we have to build the budget. How do we, you know, how do we manage this? Oh, we have to get a Basecamp account and, you know, da, da, da. How do we, you know, what does an SOW template look like? I don't know, right? But he was on that side helping us be like, well, here's something from another studio, so just use this. And so you kind of generate, you know, your materials and your processes through that. And then once you're done with that, you can actually start doing the work. And that's a whole other thing.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I imagine in the early days, hopefully, I don't know, my point of view, hopefully it balances over time, but I imagine there was a lot of late nights, weekends, crunching. Or did you set yourself the rare founder that said, actually, we're going to work a very specific number of hours and build it that way? How what was the sort of time commitment you guys were putting into it?
Oh, it was all day, all night.
Yeah,
all day, all night. It was, this was the era before, you know, cloud rendering, and the software still took a long time, and you'd have to wait there and wait for the server farm and the rendering farm in an air-cooled closet, you know, to crank out the frames to see what you made. It was early days. Mm-hmm. So real time didn't exist. So I think my wife always jokes, like, you know, the first 10 years of running the studio, like the idea of we're waiting for the renders to finish was like a t-shirt she should have printed up for like an excuse of why I wasn't home. It's like basically anytime I wasn't at home, she was just like, what, rendering? So it was kind of funny, and now we wouldn't have that problem, but we spent a lot of time late at the office waiting for things to kind of come out, then putting, you know, doing it again and putting decks together and all that stuff. So it was a beast. You know, I have to say, we could have been more, I think we both kind of came from an old school New York mentality.
Okay.
Work. It's kind of the thing, you know. It could be a generational thing. It could just be like a context. But New York makes you go fast. That's what I loved about moving back from LA. Mm. LA makes you go slow. New York makes you go fast. So just the rigor and the speed of everything else, you just want to keep up. And so that motivation kind of we took into the company. We're like, we'll keep up, you know.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. I've not lived outside of Europe, so I've never been. But I've New York. I was only there for like a couple of weeks for work, but I remember this feeling, the pace of energy in the studio that we were working in at the time. It's just a complete buzz. Whereas in London, it's a bit more relaxed. I think people are quite happy. You get a very distinct change between agency side, which is expected to be in the studio until 10 every night, in house 6 p.m. go home, or there's something going wrong. So yeah, it's a bit,
yeah, and change that. And you know, I have to say that that's what we did and how we worked. Was it necessary? I don't know. At the time, it felt necessary. Was it ideal? No. Would I build a different model if we started from scratch now? Absolutely. I mean, from a time and culture standpoint, it would be impossible to sort of build that other model, I think. Mm. And as the company matured, did we have to figure out how what we could perform and do and invest as owners couldn't be transposed to every employee? Mm. And that's not an ideal state anyway. So a lot of like the maturation of the studio was about like, how do you make it more accessible? How do you get more work that's great work without damaging, you know, the people who are doing the work? And that sort of balance is, you know, it's still difficult, right? But I think at some point the companies have to mature so they can like operationalize the work they do in order to scale. And you can't operationalize, you know, redlined 110% hours every day. You know, that's just it's not sustainable. So yeah, that's kind of, I think that's like the chapter two, you know, of the company.
Totally. So we're, you know, 15 years into Hush. I'm still always super fascinated to speak with anyone on this podcast around the culture of the studio and the processes, etc. I assume it's, as you say, it's matured as you've grown and scaled. What does the culture feel like today? If you were a Hush team member, what does it look like to be part of that community?
It's a great question, and it's also a really timely question, in the sense of the last 2 years have been an insane experience, both individually as a husband, as a parent, as a friend, as a son, and as a business owner. And the culture associated with all of those things, like what's the culture of your family, your community, your relationships? What's the culture of work? What is the future of work? What does that mean for people? What does that mean for a creative studio? You know, what are we offering that's beyond work, or is it just work? And people are seeking the beyond in their own time and their own practices. You know, these things are existential, tectonic scale changes. It's kind of cliche. You can open up the New York Times or anything right now, and I bet you on the front page there's an article floating around what we're talking about. So it's quite real. So what is it like now? I mean, you know, in our chapter three of our maturation, you know, we rolled out cultural values that we really believe in, that we use in all of our, just like we literally put them on like the second slide of a client presentation and the second slide of a new hire presentation deck. And we try to live up to them, you know, as much as we can. And I think they drive our culture. You know, these things are about being candid and curious and respectful. And these just ways, you know, you can do great work by interacting in these ways. I'd say the culture beyond just a value system is a culture where we have a very high bar, you know, not easily satisfied is probably a good starting point. I'm always pushing, you know, it's just like, I think we're intellectual and ideological. So things can get pretty heady. You know, we spend a lot of time thinking about what we're making, what we're doing, the purpose, how it sits in the world. That curiosity piece is cool. People like pull on threads, you know, what would that do? And how might that work? And I made this experiment for no reason. I was just testing out how A plugged into B and look at what we made. And that's kind of the vibe. I don't know. You know, I maybe my team would say otherwise, but I think leadership for sure tries to create spaces where kind of any idea and any thought and any contribution is a good one. We've had, you know, interns come up with ideas that became fully built environments, you know, over many years. So the idea that inspiration and ideas can come from anywhere is true, and I think we try to mine for that. So those are, I would say, some of the kind of vibes, and I still think we're constantly trying to improve and maybe live up to them even more. You know, there's been, you know, over 15 years, you know, we've had ebbs and flows of that culture where sometimes it's like, Jesus, this is like insanely inspirational. And people are just making and making and making, and there's just no end. And then we've had times where we're more in that like building process and really refining stuff. And it feels good and like on the rails, but maybe less like unbridled, you know, break the rules. It's more than they could ever want or afford, or it's possible, but let's just show it anyway. So you kind of always refining and optimizing, and then you're like, okay, we're optimized, but we need to push the creative. And then you push the creative and it sort of breaks some of your optimization. And it's like, that was so cool, but oh man, we lost a bunch of money. And you know, then you're trying to optimize again. And so it's never static, but I'd like to have our ideals and our culture kind of on the wall, so to speak, so that when we get farther away from it, we can kind of pull ourselves back to it, or we can acknowledge that we're a click or two away from the things we hold dear. We got to work to get it back, you know?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's a really interesting point as well, is this notion of knowing who you are and what you're working towards being as your ideals, and having that, I suppose, fluidity to change. We talk a lot in my studio about process and the pros and cons of being very rigid with that, particularly with scaling that you know, like sort of $1 billion brands, like system level designs. How do you do that? Yeah. And if process is a hindrance, which it sometimes is, or if it's the enabler for creativity, and I think it's constantly just trying to find that, how do you bring up those two dials of sort of consistency and process and creative freedom? And that balance is just always done and depending on the makeup of the team, who you've got coming into it. And so when you say process, I think it's got to come back down to those ideals, those values, and then the rest of it kind of shapes around the landscape. That's kind of where my conclusion, it sounds similar to maybe where Hush is as well. It's kind of just it's always an evolution.
Oh yeah. The idea that you conceive of something and design a business and then it's just like runs is just absolutely false. So I think part of the best thing you can be as an entrepreneur and a leader of a business is, you know, that change is inevitable, and the faster you can adapt to it, the better. That doesn't mean you need to pivot a business from what your offering is. To be fair, we're an experienced design studio in the real world. So in March of 2020, we were contemplating whether our entire business model has a reason to exist, right? Mm-hmm. So there are existential moments where you're like, can we just plod through and keep doing this? Or do we literally need to pivot into something else to stay alive? And so that was one of those moments. Thankfully, we just put our foot on the gas and we're like, we can do a bunch of other stuff and strategy work and, you know, storytelling work and virtualization of things. And da, da, da. So we did a lot of that, but neither here nor there. I mean, you need to know where you want to go and what you're doing, but how you do that, you can flex and change based on realities or just changes in life and culture and external and internal factors. So I think being able to be pretty nimble and adaptable is absolutely key. Mm-hmm. And not dogmatic. You know, it's like sometimes you have a process and you do this thing and it really generally works out better if you do this over and over and over again, and everyone knows the plan and they know the path and they have the map. Sometimes in the middle of that process, something new happens and you discover something that you never thought was possible. And if you just were to squash that out because it's technically off process or would break your process, you're literally crushing potentially your next best idea, your next innovation, your next new offering. And so you have to figure out how to recognize that, pull that out, and it's okay if you're improvising. And that's it. I mean, one of our creative directors years ago had said, you know, and I think this is said by several folks, you know, in the world, but it's a lot like jazz. It's a lot like jazz in that, you know, you have a band, so the company's your band, and everyone knows when they start the song, they know the melody, they know the basics, and they know the time signature, so they know how fast to play. And so there is a process and a rhythm, and it's clear. And if you're off rhythm or you don't know the melody, you're not playing in the band. But once you have that, each band member has this opportunity to kind of go off in solo, sometimes, you know, way out into the atonalness of jazz potential, but come back and land at a moment and everybody syncs back up together. And I think that's kind of a cool way to think about it. It's like the underlying march of the song keeps everyone together, even if people float off and try to find some, you know, out of sync, out of phase, out of tone, out of key inspiration. And then we all come back together. You know, I don't know if that's a project or a lifetime in a business, but it works kind of at all time levels.
Yeah. It's a great analogy. I think that totally makes sense to me. And I'd love to keep diving into this, but I'm also conscious of time. And then we've got a couple of other bits to get your thoughts on before we wrap up today.
Yeah.
But I think what a great way to conclude on that section. So I would like to kind of just reflect on a couple of large questions, I suppose, hopefully not too large questions, with guests. The first one being, you know, we're obviously super both really into design. You've got, you know, decades of experience building amazing projects and solutions. Have you formulated a conclusion on your personal definition of great design?
I think great design comes through, there's a couple pieces to it, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk about internal first. I think it comes through rigorous making. I'm a little old school. I think you can't get there without exploring every nook and cranny of possibility. The exhaustive work to crank out things, enough things that you can see truly what's possible, and then you can self-curate down to the things that work the best. And I think there's no substitute for that. Maybe that comes from design school where, you know, in a typography class, you have to do 200 type layouts on a white rectangle. And you're like, how many places can I put three words, you know, to make, you know? But the act of doing it gives you the knowledge of what's working and what's not. And you quickly go down to 10 things that are powerful, you know? And so I really have a theory of great design comes from making a lot internally before you show externally. So making a ton, self-curating with expertise, knowledge, and then showing just one or two precious things. And clients, the best clients trust that that making has happened with rigor. And what you're showing is the cream of the crop, and you've done that curation for them because that's your expertise, not theirs. So that's kind of maybe what gets to great design. And also it's a cheat because I'm not a great designer, but I'm a really good curator. So I need rigor and quantity to be able to draw connections and find the constellation of the stars. If I don't have quantity or diversity in ideas and thinking, it's hard for me to know what could be right. So I kind of use that with my team. And then in terms of impact, which I guess is external, I think design has to have value, right? So it's not inert. It has to be performing at some level. So it has to be performing for the user. And that's pretty cliche, but performance can mean a lot of stuff. In our world, qualitative things sort of rule because we often don't have the rigor of the data and metrics to the sort of digital application layer level that we could truly prove out performance quantitatively. We have a whole way we talk about it and we frame it up with our clients about how we understand, are we hitting our KPIs and delivering ROI and those kind of things. But I think great design has to have impact. But I'm a firm believer that impact can come in very qualitative ways. That if you do it right, you can have pretty transformative experiences for people. Like moments where they're blown away, inspired, and they have a moment where they're like, I've never seen this before. I've never been in a context like this before. I've never seen information or ideas presented to me in a form like this before. And those things that's memory generation. I mean, you can really, really connect with somebody in that. And so I think if you're rigorous on the creation, rigorous in the curation, and then you are really leaned into the strength of impact of the design, I think you got a pretty solid, great design idea, you know?
Yeah, I love that. Very well said. Very well said. And I think that's particularly in your space and some of the projects I've been looking through. The one that Instagram's Lightforce really stood out to me, and then the work you did at Uber's headquarters. And I'm experiencing this just on 2D screen, right? But you can already start to feel the energy and the emotion of that. And I do think that's one of the challenges we see with more single dimensional projects like apps and websites that I typically work on. And I think Gadi Amit mentioned this when I spoke with him last year on the podcast as well, it all feels, you know, we see a lot of repetition because it's become, I think it's more curated to be on this quantifiable aspect. Like we're very obsessed with the data, and the emotional layer is very hard for a lot of businesses to get behind. But when you feel it, you feel it. And I think it is exponentially more powerful than how many people clicked on XYZ, if we're getting a percentage of people coming around and saying, that blew me away, I need to share that with people. But that's so hard to measure. But the qual was so important to great design.
Yeah, and I respect and value the quantitative pieces. And in some ways, it'd be an incredible relief if we could attribute that level of detail to assessing our own work and evaluating with our clients. You know, sometimes I wish we could have a simpler and more direct means. Because obviously design is design and you need to iterate it and improve it. So if you don't have the data and the feedback in any meaningful way, you can't improve.
Can't evolve.
So there's that. But I think that special impact and feeling you're talking about is real. One of the hard parts of experience design work is articulating what that might feel like and be like to someone like a client who may have never have made something like this before. And so it's like talking about an abstract idea. They can kind of understand it, but it's not resonating internally. So that's sort of a business development challenge, I would say, for any kind of company in our world.
Yeah, totally agreed. My final question for you, and it's again on these sort of reflective queries. If you could travel back in time, knowing what you've learned over the last couple of decades, life, business, design, what advice would you give your 18-year-old self?
Oh man, my 18-year-old self was a mess. So anything I would say would help that person. I would say I've had a pretty circuitous path to here, which I value. I'm sort of constantly confused and unsatisfied person trying to always find out what else is out there. So that path is kind of expected, you know, it was never going to be a straight line. And I think there's a real danger to trying to make everything a straight line, right? Steve Jobs was like, in retrospect, everything's a straight line, but in whatever, I'm butchering the quote, but the idea is like, you can tie your history together and it's very neat and packaged, but in the moment you're zigging and zagging, you know? I'm not advocating for that straight line or to always just pick a thing and focus on it, because that wouldn't be true to my own experience. But I would say for my 18-year-old self, I knew already what lit me up, what excited me. I just spent another 3 years ignoring it for factors that I maybe don't yet know or haven't yet come to terms with, whether it was expectations from family or fear or, I don't know. But I should have listened to myself more and more honestly at that time. And I think I would have made better or different decisions than I made, you know, subsequently. So again, I'm not going to say my path was wrong. I just think it's maybe like, listen to what really lights you up, because everyone knows it. You know, when you touch that thing where you're in flow state and it just feels awesome and you get lost in it, you know, you can make that thing your job. You just got to really focus on how to connect that to, you know, but if you focus on that kind of fire, it's going to last you your entire career. As soon as you're doing something that doesn't light you up, you can put in the hours and grit it out, but it's never going to be the thing that just keeps you moving, you know?
Yeah, totally agree. That is a really good note to wrap up on. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been like, I could spend hours talking about all this stuff, and maybe we'll do offline. Really appreciate you coming on, David. It's been great.
Amazing. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Before we wrap up entirely, if people want to reach out, I think we mentioned a website before, but how can people learn more about your portfolio and get in touch?
Yeah, so the website's heyhush.com. Hush is the studio. Hey was like, hey, hello. Worst URL we ever picked. So, you know, don't call us Hey Hush. We're Hush, but that's the URL. If folks want to reach out, I think actually LinkedIn's the best way, like get me there. and happy to discuss anything, or if it's folks who are interested in this career, happy to connect you with some folks in our HR and talk through what it takes and ways in.
Cool, man. Thank you so much. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today on the Design Podcast. The show is produced by the Snook Brothers, hosted by Ash and Snook, and edited by Eric Snook. If you enjoyed the episode, we'd appreciate you leaving a star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Stay connected with us on Instagram or LinkedIn. Our handle is design_podcast. Or check out the website designpodcast.co. Thanks again, and take care, folks.